Ought that we take up a study that we haven't dealt with so far in the camp meeting, something fresh for us each one, but which will at the same time be simply bringing forth again the great lesson of living righteously by faith. It carries us back to the great lesson that Jesus taught while he is here upon the earth. As I read it on page 31 and 32 of Steps to Christ, 54 in this particular edition, and the second page in Faith and Acceptance. And I want to spell out this lesson tonight in clear and simple terms and turn our minds back to the Old Testament, the book of Job. You know, few people realize, well, I think that most people realize that the book of Romans in the New Testament is the great book that deals with righteousness by faith in all the Bible. But just as the book of Revelation has its counterpart in the book of Daniel in the Old Testament, so it is that the book of Romans has its counterpart in the Old Testament too. And that book is the book of Job. Now, first of all, I want to state the lesson that we have to learn. And then we shall turn back to the book of Job and see how it is that Job lived by that lesson. Absolutely lived by that lesson. And because he lived by that lesson, he was victorious, and God said of him that he had spoken of the Father that which was right. And so we read here in this little book, Steps to Christ, these words. Perhaps I should read the sentence before on the previous page. Now go to him and ask that he will wash away your sins and give you a new heart. Then, that is, then having gone to him and having asked for the new heart, believe that he does this because he has promised. Now then, Sister White says, this is the lesson which Jesus taught while he was on earth, that the gift which God promises us, we must believe we do receive, and it is ours. Now, I believe this, and I believe it very emphatically too, that inasmuch as this is the lesson that Jesus came to teach to his people while he was upon this earth, that not one of us should rest, not one of us should rest until we have learned this lesson in theory, and still not rest until we have translated the theory into practice, into a living experience. Now let's put it down here on the board, clear and simple and plain. This, says Sister White, is the lesson. The lesson which Jesus came to teach. And of course, if it is the lesson which he came to teach, then obviously it is the lesson which we must learn. And what is the lesson? That the gift which God promises us, so here is the gift promised, we are to believe we do receive, in other words, we are to receive it by faith, and having received it by faith, it is ours. And from that point of reception, we go forth with the precious gift to meet whatever may come along the way. In other words, when we receive this gift, and that gift, as we noted at the camp, I'm just reviewing a few principles before we take the book of Job up, that gift is the life of Christ. His life is his righteousness. His righteousness is his victory. And so it is that as a righteous person, because when you receive that gift, you have received him, you go forth not hoping to gain the victory, but proceeding from a point of a victory already achieved. That is the great lesson to be learned. And if in the hour of need, at this point here when the tempter comes, here is the tempter, if we can meet him in the sure knowledge, not that we are going to get the victory, that we already have the victory, and meet every single argument he brings against us with that mighty assurance, then we shall find that the devil will have no power over us, none at all. As Sister White says on the very next page in Steps to Christ, she says these words.
What's that Greek word?
Tempter. T-E-M-P-T-E-R. Tempter. As Sister White says here in the next page, if, here's the condition, if you believe the promise, believe that you are forgiven and cleansed, God supplies the fact. You are made whole just as Christ gave the paralytic power to walk when the man believed that he was healed. It is so if you believe it. Now Sister White says there, if you believe the promise, believe one that you are, not will be, but that you are, present tense, that you are forgiven, and that you are, present tense, cleansed, then if you believe that, God supplies the fact. Let's turn back now to the book of Job and see how it is that Job came to Jesus and received this righteousness and lived a life which God himself described as being a perfect and a blameless life. How Satan came down and did his absolute uttermost to break Job's faith in what God had done for him, and how Job absolutely refused, even in the face of the most tremendous evidences of sight and circumstances, to yield to the arguments of his friend, but steadfastly maintained that God had given him this gift and he would not let it go. And how in the end, when the test was all over, God came down and said to Job that he had spoken the thing which was right. Let's turn back to the book of Job and we'll read the story. And I shan't this evening spend any time on the tests which Job faced in the outset. Wherever we covered that ground last evening, we'll need to refer to it again to show you the tremendous faith of Job. I want you to consider, if you can, just what Job went through. We'll turn back to chapter 1. In the first verse of the chapter, you'll recall that the Bible says that there was a man in the land of Uz whose name is Job, a perfect and upright man, one who feared God and eschewed or hated evil. He hated evil with a perfect hatred. He lived the life of the righteousness of God and satisfied the requirements of God's law. Now we find, if we turn to verse 6 in this chapter, this little conversation between God and Satan, after which Satan is permitted to go out and try Job. Now, I want you to put yourself in Job's position. He was a wealthy man. God had marvelously blessed the work of his hands, and he had houses, and he had lands, he had servants, he had flocks, He had herds, and what was most precious back in those days, he had a very, very fine family. And it wasn't a small one. How big was it? I don't think it says in the first case, does it? It tells you how many he received in the end. I think in the first case...
He had 12 sons and 12 daughters, didn't
he? Now, seven sons and... Verse 2, seven sons and three daughters. That's right. Seven sons and three daughters. And they were very precious in Job's eyes, as you can imagine. Now, imagine yourself sitting one day, as Job appears to have been, in his home, when all of a sudden, as you read in verse 14, there comes a messenger to Job in haste and says to him, the oxen were ploughing and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. Now, that would be a pretty bad shock. But before this servant even gets through speaking, another servant comes running in. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the fire of God is fallen from heaven, and hath burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. Before Job could recover from the shock of this second announcement, verse 17 says, a third servant came running and said, the Chaldeans made out three bands and fell upon the camels and have carried them away, yea, and slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. And while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness, and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead, and I only am escaped to learn to tell thee. Now try and put yourself in Job's position if you can, and think how you would feel if one, two, three, four tremendous catastrophes were announced to you in as rapid succession as that, until you found yourself deprived of every single thing which is worthwhile in your life. Your sons and your daughters, last of all and most precious of all. How would you have felt? Be pretty devastating, wouldn't it? Wouldn't your first thought have been, why does God treat me like this, when all my life I have been faithful and true to his commandments? That would be the first great temptation, wouldn't it? But what did Job do? Verse 20. Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped and said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That's faith, isn't it? That is absolute submission to God's will. Absolute. And when we have come to that place in our experience when our faith will match the faith of Job, then we shall truly know what it means to be a completely victorious Christian. Well, Satan, of course, doesn't mind how much he wounds and kills and hurts the people of God. And so when God laid the challenge before him in chapter 2, verse 4, Satan said, skin for skin, yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. But put forth thine hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee unto thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, behold, he is in thine hand, but save his life. So when Satan forth from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. And he took him a potsherd to scrape himself withal, and he sat down among the ashes. Now I want you to think, I suppose that each one of us in our lifetime had at least one boil at one time.
And they're extremely painful things, aren't they? But can you imagine yourself being covered with them from the head of your top of your head to the sole of your feet? Wouldn't it be an agony? Think of the putrefaction. And think of the feeling of being so dirty and diseased and sick. And think of the fever which is raged through his whole system. And you know, when a man gets sick, that is when he is most prone to discouragement. Isn't it? Most prone to discouragement.
Amen.
Now then, before I go on, I want to go with you now further into the book of Job and just look into his past life just a little bit and learn something about this man. Over here in the 29th chapter of the book of Job. Now, before we do look at this chapter, however, we'll just consider God's announcement about Job in the first chapter. And there we found that God said about Job, he was perfect and upright. Now, coming back to the man in the Romans 7 experience, we find that this man has a mental assent to the law and an outward conformity. Now, I want to ask you the question. Here is a man who is striving with all his powers, with all his might to keep the law of God, is very respectable, very well honored by his fellow church members, but would God say about this man that he was perfect and upright? Definitely not. Sure. That's the point. About whom only would God say a perfect and an upright man? A man who had passed from the experience of trying to save himself into the experience of Romans 8 or Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4 saying that he which has ceased from his own labors or his own works hath entered into his rest. And so then the righteousness which Job had achieved was a righteousness which he had achieved by faith. In other words, in Job, the old man was what? Dead. And he was alive unto God. Now then, that was accepted by faith. He was conscious of it by faith. He knew that God had given him the precious gift, and he lived upon that assurance. In other words, Job could say, knowing this, that my old man is crucified with him, the body of sin is destroyed, that henceforth I should not serve sin. That was Job's experience. And it's evident by the fact that God himself said of Job, a perfect and an upright man. Now come to chapter 29. Job now is reminiscing, and Sister White says when we get to the dark places in our lives, we have to look back over the past and recall the precious experiences where we have walked with Jesus and recall those evidences as assurances that God is with us still. Now see just what happens here in this chapter. Moreover, Paul continued his parable and said, all that I were as in months past, as in the days when God preserved me. Ever had the experience of coming down to the valley of the shadow of death? When you seem to be forsaken by God and man? I certainly have. And you look back over your past experience and you think of that time when you had that sweet fellowship in that camp meeting with those people over yonder. Or maybe when you're studying with that particular brother and the blessing of the Lord seemed to be upon all your labors. And oh, how you long to go back to that time. And back to that days, and be in that experience all over again. And here Paul had been brought to that place in his life. And so he describes his experience. In verse 3 he said, when his candle shined upon my head, and when by his light I walked through darkness, as I was in the days of my youth,
when the secret of God was upon my tabernacle, when the Almighty was yet with me and my children were about me, I washed my steps with butter and the rock poured me out rivers of oil. When I went out to the gate through the city, when I prepared my seat in the street, the young men saw me and hid themselves, and the aged arose and stood up. The princes refrained talking and laid their hand in their mouth. The nobles held their peace, and their tongue cleaved to the roof of their mouth. When the ear heard me, then it blessed me, and when the eye saw me, it gave witness to me. Because I delivered the poor that cried, and the fatherless, and him that had none to help him, the blessing of him that was ready to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. And notice verse 14, it says here, I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My judgment was as a robe and a diadem. Note his words. He put on righteousness. Whose righteousness? Christ's righteousness. And having put it on, having received it, whose then did it become? Job's very own possession. Didn't it? Job's very own possession. And so he goes back to that precious day when he laid hold upon that righteousness, and the fruit of it is attested by the fact that of him, God said, a perfect and an upright man. God said it, not man at all. Now then, this righteousness he received by faith. He had learned the great lesson that Jesus came to teach, that we are to receive that gift by faith and then believe that what we have received we actually do possess. All right. Now I want you to notice in the story how the devil came down and in his absolute uttermost to break Job's faith in what God had laid upon him. His uttermost. And I want you to learn the lesson of Job's life, because you must be very sure of this thing. That as you go forth from this place, as our ways part, as they certainly will in a day or two, and as you find yourself standing very often alone against the enemies of truth, Satan is going to do his uttermost to break your faith in what God has wrought in your hearts over the last few days and the last couple of weeks. He'll do his uttermost. He'll use your best friends, as was Job's case. He'll use your partner in life, maybe, but he'll do his best to break it. So come back to Job again, chapter 2, and notice what happens. Verse 7 and 8 told the story of him coming down with boils. And verse 9 we read this, then said his wife unto him, his wife, the one who was nearest and dearest to him in this world, she said, dost thou still retain thy integrity? Curse God and die. Curse God and die. How was Job standing? Alone, wasn't he? Absolutely alone. And worse than that, his nearest and dearest companion in life was against him, his very wife. Suppose you felt the pain of the losses? Of course she did. Her sons and her daughters were all dead. 7 sons and 3 daughters. And all the family wealth was gone. Where now was her social status amongst the nations around about? It was gone. And her security in life? It was gone. Her husband's health was gone. What did she have left? Nothing. Did she share Job's faith? No. Because whereas Job sinned, the Lord gave and the Lord hath taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord, she said, curse God and die. Now in verse 11 we read, when Job's three what? Friends, not enemies, but when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite.
for they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, they lifted up their voice and wept. And they rent everyone his mantle, and sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. So they sat there with him upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great. Now think of it. 7 days and nights of unspeakable agony. 7 days and nights of silent sympathy. And at the end of that time, no doubt, Job would be amazed at the love that these men would show to him. They came in a loving way. They came in a gentle way. They came as his friends. But that is the kind of arguments they brought against him. We haven't time, of course, unfortunately, to read the whole book of Job through this evening. We'll just have to pick up the arguments as we go along. But if you read chapter 3 through sometime, chapter 3, you will find that Job is wishing he'd never been born. Do you blame him?
No.
Hardly. He was expressing the depth of abject misery to which he'd been brought. The depth of abject misery. Now we find that in chapter 4, these men now, and no doubt in times past they'd had some discussions about righteousness by faith, and no doubt they had been proponents of the sinfulness of man's nature idea. And that man must always recognize himself as being sinful. And that we can't be righteous this side of, translation anyway. The age-old argument that goes forth so often today, that we just can't keep that law and no one's righteous at all. And yet at the same time they say, well, you've got to be perfect, but you can't be perfect. And it's double talk. Now then, chapter 4, we read this. And Eliphaz the Temanite comes right down to the very heart of the controversy in 6 or 7 short verses. And here he says, then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, if we essay to commune with thee, wilt thou be grieved? But who can withhold himself from speaking? Behold, thou hast instructed many, and thou hast strengthened the weak hands. Thy words have upholden him that was falling, and thou hast strengthened the feeble knees. But now it is come upon thee, and thou faintest. It toucheth thee, and thou art troubled. Now in the first case he is saying, all right, Job, you've been a preacher of righteousness. But now, let's see if your message is going to work in this, your own time of trouble. See? And virtually they were saying, it isn't. We can't see in what's going on here, all this great lament that you've been pouring forth about your own condition, all we can see here is a faithless man who is weeping and moaning under God's condemnation. They misunderstood Job when they said that. Misunderstood him altogether. Because as the rest of the book shows, Job's faith was not in any sense of the word shaken by his experience. He was miserable, and he said so. And he told the truth, because he was miserable. Now note these next two verses. And they said to him, is not this thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, and the uprightness of thy ways? Now I wish I had an RSV here tonight, because really the study is best given from an RSV. It expresses these words so much more clearly. So what they're saying is this, that Job was placing his confidence and his hope in the righteousness which he had received from God. That was his hope. Is not this thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, and the uprightness of thy ways? And then Eliphaz says, remember, he says, I pray thee, who ever perished being innocent? Or where were the righteous cut off? Where? In other words, just as in the study we had at camp, Satan pointed Christ's attention to the witness of sight and circumstances, so these mouthpieces of Satan, as we proved to you last night from Job 42 verse 7, were focusing Job's attention on the witness of sight. And they were saying to him, Job, you are standing upon the edge of your grave. Now tell us, when did God ever bring a righteous man, as you claim to be, down to this kind of pass? Can't you see, in the very evidences of the situation to which you have been brought, the sure proof that you are under the mighty judgments of God because of the fearful sinfulness of your life, and because you have dared to believe that God has given to you his own righteousness? Now, what a discouragement that would be. We find this thought develop further as we go along through the book. As we see, let's turn now to chapter 5. You remember the verse we read last night from the last part of chapter 4, where Eliphaz said, now look, can a mortal man be just before God? Can a man be pure before his Maker? Of course not. It just can't be done. Now, come to chapter 5. Call now, said Eliphaz to Job, if there be any that will answer thee, and to which of the saints wilt thou turn? For wrath killeth the foolish man, and envy slayeth the silly one. I have seen the foolish taking root, but suddenly I cursed his habitation. His children are far from safety, and they are crushed in the gate, neither is there any to deliver them. Now, just get the inference here if you can. In verse 3 it says, I have seen the foolish taking root, but suddenly I cursed his habitation. His children are far from safety, and they are crushed in the gate, neither is there any to deliver them. What had just happened to Job's children? That's right. Far from safety they appeared to human eyes to be. God had taken them, sure, in his own good time, in his own good way. Had they been crushed in the gate? Yes. Had there been anyone to deliver them? No. Therefore the inference was that Job as a foolish man had taken root. See the inference, the charge being laid? A righteous man? Oh no, a foolish man, a man self-deceived. And so he said in verse 5 and on, whose harvest the hungry eateth up, and taketh it even out of the thorns, and the robbers swalloweth up their substance. Had not the Chaldeans made out bands, taken away his substance? Although affliction cometh not forth of the dust, neither doth trouble spring out of the ground, yet man is born into trouble as the sparks fly upwards. Then he says, I would seek unto God, and to God would I commit my cause. But what had Job done? Just that very thing. He had given all to God, and everything was safe in God's hands. Now, we come now to Job's answer in chapter 6. I won't read the many, many words. We shall come over here to verse 29. As we go back a little on, verse 24 and on, just to get the context, teach me and I will hold my tongue, and cause me to understand wherein I have erred. How forcible are right words, but what doth your arguing reprove? Do you imagine to reprove words in the speeches of one that is desperate, which are as wind? Yea, you overwhelm the fatherless, and you dig a pit for your friend. Now therefore be content, look upon me, for it is evident unto you if I lie. Imagine a reason that is, for surely I shall not lie to your face. Return, I pray you, let it not be iniquity. Yea, return again. My righteousness is in it. Or as the margin says, I want you to notice this tremendous statement of faith on Job's part. I'll read it now as the margin of reading puts it. Yea, return again. My righteousness is still in me. Isn't that a tremendous statement of faith?
Yeah.
Tremendous. Think about it if you can. There he was with the loss of all he possessed, of all he had in the way of health and all the rest of it, brought down to the place where he wished he could die. And here were three friends. And just cast your mind around among some of the friends who are going to be your evil counselors as you go and see them shortly. And here were they trying to argue to him that he must be a desperately wicked man to have been brought to this place. And what did he say? I have taken hold of the righteousness of Christ, I have received it, and I have it. And then he says in these words, return, I pray you, let it not be iniquity, yea, return again. My righteousness is still in me. There it is. Well now, Bildad the Shuhite takes up the same argument as does Zophar, what's his name again? Eliphaz as a Temanite in chapter 8. Then answered Bildad the Shuhite and said, how long wilt thou speak these things? And how long shall the words of thy mouth be like a strong wind? Doth God pervert judgment, or doth the Almighty pervert justice? If thy children have sinned against him, and he have cast them away for their transgression, if thou would seek unto God betimes and make thy supplication to the Almighty. Now listen, verse 6 says, if thou wert pure and upright, surely now he would await for thee and make the habitation of thy righteousness prosperous. Remember what Satan said to Jesus in the wilderness? He said, if thou be the Son of God. Do you hear the echo of the same words in this verse?
Yeah.
If thou wert pure and upright. In other words, the insinuation is, you think you're pure and upright. You think that God has come in and given you his righteousness. But no man can have this righteousness and live a perfect life. We're sinners. We were born sinners. We can't keep that law. And we're going to go on being sinners right down to the very end. And so we find Bildad the Shuhite arguing the same thing. Verse 20, behold, God will not cast away a perfect man, neither will he help the evildoers. And so they're pressing upon Job all the time the argument that he must be a terribly sinful man to be in this awful condition. Now in verse 11 we find that they're pinpointing Job's argument still. Then answered Zophar the Naamathite and said, should not the multitude of words be answered? And should a man full of talk be justified? Should thy lies make men hold their peace? And when thou mockest, shall no man make thee ashamed? All right, let's review Job's experience again.
What chapter is it?
Chapter 9. I beg your pardon, chapter 11. Now, here was that point of time when here Job had laid hold of righteousness. He laid hold upon it there, and he'd gone along through life, and then at this point here had come these terrible calamities. Then we find these friends coming along, and in spite of all this trouble, Job's conscience was still clear. He searched his heart, he could find no sin there that he was conscious of. All right. Now, here he testified, here, to what God had given to him back there. And he said, God gave that righteousness to me there, and what he gave to me there is still in me here. See the point? Now, what did they say? They said to him in chapter 11, verse 3, should not thy lies make men hold their peace? You see that? Thy lies. They said you're a liar when you say that you've got that righteousness. You haven't got it. By no means have you got it. Now we read on. Now notice the connection that here. I know that they're referring to this statement because the next verse says, for should not thy lies make men hold their peace? And when thou mockest, should no man make thee ashamed? For thou hast said, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in thine eyes. I am clean in thine eyes. Now he knew he was a righteous man by faith and trust in God. But all that God would speak and open his lips against thee. You know, And this is a very precious thought to me. The Lord says to me today, and he says to you, walk before me and be thou perfect. A man will stand or fall before his Maker. Today, there are a thousand voices in this land and in this world, each of whom is going to rise up against the man who testifies to what God has done in his heart, and will declare that man to be of the devil. And he will say to us all that God would speak and open his lips against me. Now at the end of this book, at the end of this experience, God did speak. And what did he say to these three men? He said to them, you have not spoken to me the thing which is right, as my servant Job hath. And God vindicated Job and not them. And they trembled in their shoes at the end of this book for fear of their very lives. Verse 6, and that he would show thee the secrets of wisdom, that they are double to that which is. Know therefore, notice this awful statement of discouragement to Job. Know therefore, said Zophar, that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserveth. Less. In other words, they said to him, you are such a wicked creature, so full of the devil, that if God really gave to you all you deserve, you'd be blotted out of existence. You know, if people come to you and they say to you, you're a wicked man, you're full of the devil, and all the rest of it, and they hammer this at you, what is the fearful temptation to believe? But what they say is the truth, isn't it? Especially if you're all alone, especially.